Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am one of your co-hosts, Paul David, CEO and co-founder of Literal Humans. I will let three of my colleagues with me today, which is exciting, introduce themselves. I'll start with my faithful co-host, Will.
Hey, team. Got a jam-packed podcast there. We've got five folk on it. Seeing as we're going to be focusing on branding and design, we've brought in our creative director and our senior designer, Annabelle and Olivia. Annabelle, say hello.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, everyone. I'm Olivia, the newest senior graphic designer for Literal Humans.
And we're chuffed today to have, we were just on her podcast, Danielle Clark, marketing and brand consultant and host of Build Better Brands podcast. Welcome, Danielle.
Thank you for that lovely welcome, Paul. Good to see you again, Will. And hello, Olivia and Annabelle. Nice to meet you both.
Nice to meet you too.
Very nice to meet you.
We had such a great time on your podcast, Danielle. It was just like 2 or 3 weeks ago. We had to have you back immediately. So thanks for jumping on our pod.
Appreciate that. Like I was saying, like it's really weird being the guest. It makes a nice change from being a host. So yeah, really looking forward to chatting.
Well, we'll try to make you more comfortable and just get into, we're going to talk all things about the future of design, talk about recent acquisition of Figma by Adobe and some of the controversy that's stirred up. Yeah, we'll take it from there. But for our audience, Danielle, do you want to just kind of introduce what you do and maybe talk briefly just about your podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. So ultimately, I help businesses, especially small businesses, entrepreneurs, solopreneurs really understand the power of branding. I think a lot of small businesses think that because they're small, that they don't need or can't focus on the brand. And I'm trying to bridge that gap between them being able to understand what branding is and how it can work for them. I also lecture at Birmingham University. Your listeners can probably tell I am a Brummie, which is really cool because I'm helping to kind of shape and influence the next future of designers and creative thinkers. So very privileged and enjoying what I'm doing.
Awesome. Well, as we do with every episode of Tech Can Save Us, let's jump right into the headlines. We shared two top of mind recent articles with everyone here, and let's just make it a conversation. The first piece is from Forbes and talks about basically, you know, this new world of text to image AI. So they cover, hope I'm going to pronounce this right, one of the first text image models, which is OpenAI's DALL-E. It's DALL-E. Google just came out with one in May called Imagen. There's a few others out there, you know, Midjourney, Stability.ai. One big question I have from this piece is what does this mean for designers? You know, one of the things I've heard about, you know, startup world and AI in general is this whole move from text to everything. So basically a key skill is going to be, you know, you just type something in and the AI does it and creates an image or creates, you know, a whole paragraph or a whole blog post. But super curious about what this crew in particular thinks about, you know, text to image means for designers and just the profession of design.
This is something that's come up actually quite recently for me because we are at university, the students are looking at different themes. Within these themes, they're then going to write an essay and develop a whole editorial around it. And one of those themes is hyperconnectivity. And under that, AI has actually come up. And I was having a conversation with one of my students yesterday around AI specifically and the way it's kind of changing design and changing the landscape. And the thing that we really kind of found is that it's really great that you can input this data. You can tell AI what to do, you know, text to image. You can type in Batman in New York wearing a cowboy hat, holding balloons, for example. And it'll come out, which is really cool, but you have to input that data in order for the AI to actually be able to put that out. It can't create something without you inputting something, and there's no, it can't really create any really original content, in my opinion. It has to kind of come from a human first, then into the AI, you know, software. So I think that's where some of the barriers will be.
One of the things I noticed too is that it's already being deployed, right? So Kraft Heinz is using it. You know, they experimented it with one of their advertising campaigns. They were talking in the article about it, you know, influencing the world of architecture already. Yeah, super curious to hear what this crew thinks about how it's already being, you know, applied in the market and what the prospects are for the future.
I've seen it kind of thrown around as well, like especially also in the art world, because I think a lot of artists are like, "What is going on?" Because it's the same thing I've seen paintings created. Just people experimenting with it. It is wild, and I think it's something fun to experiment, but I I personally, yeah, I think it's inevitable that we want to explore these technologies and sciences, and giving the futuristic world that, you know, we created visually as artists or creatives, you know, with these films too, like that's just something that kind of inevitable that we want to explore. But I haven't thought too much of it because, well, at first I did think of it like, well, what are my artist friends going to think? But then sometimes is it just a tool that maybe there's generations of artists will use this technology for their benefit and still want to print something in a world architecture. I think that's always been explored for a long time with all the renderings and everything, but it's not necessary that it can build something that actually practical within guidelines and structures. And I don't know, maybe I'm just rambling, just talking through it and trying to understand where it will fit within our world.
I mean, I suppose like in terms of like the graphic design world, years and years ago when graphic design first came out, people would have probably looked at tools we use today like Canva or Illustrator and think, oh, that's kind of cheating, or oh, that's actually a really simplistic version of what we do now. So maybe in the future, this would just be that kind of applied. You know, AI simulated art was, oh, okay, maybe that's a bit cheating, but actually it's just a really handy tool that could potentially help us. There was that art competition, I think, like in September, and a guy won with a really, really beautiful painting, and it turned out to be AI generated, and he got a lot of shtick from the art community for A, submitting that piece, and then actually winning the competition with it.
I want to know how they found out that the painting was AI. Like, have they got an AI tool that checked it?
So I think he actually just told them.
After he came the prize money.
But that would be cool, though.
That would be cool. And that's what, like, that's what's popping in my head, you know, when maybe technology can, in that sort of situation, would have been great if actually it would have gone through a piece of software. It was like, no, this hasn't been created by a person. This has been created by a robot. You know, I think they have some kind of technology like that for checking to see if art is fake or not. If it's been, what's the word? I can't find it. Yeah, fake. That'll do.
Is it fake if he programmed the AI and the AI executed on his directions? That's one of the things the article said, was like, it's going to unleash a hornet's nest of copyright and intellectual property issues. So like, is that technically his IP if he programmed the AI and the AI did what he said?
I feel like that's difficult.
That is difficult.
I mean, if it makes you feel better, the piece also is like, and I have no clue what the answer to that question is. So, neither does this specialist lawyer that I've asked to give an opinion on it. We're not going to come up with the answer on this pod.
I mean, given how the world is, it's the same thing. It's like, I don't know, do we still have IP anymore? Some places, everything's out there. Everything's been done in a way. I feel like if he's using this as a tool, it's almost like working smarter. He knew what he was getting to. Maybe, I don't know, maybe to me, like maybe it is his IP, a new IP. I don't know. There's a whole, that just creates a whole other job market for lawyers. And
I mean, like, is it the difference between someone like using Adobe Illustrator to illustrate faster and maybe more effectively than doing it by hand, or sort of, and maybe I'm misunderstanding the practice of design here, but like, would you knock an illustrator who effectively uses Adobe Illustrator versus, you know, a more analog tool or something like that and say it's less of their IP because they use Adobe?
I wouldn't say that. It's just a tool that is generating a visual image versus analog, but you're still creating images that is by you. But the tools that you use, the medium is just different.
Danielle, you used, like, I think you said Batman in as an example, an earlier one.
Yeah.
I wonder as well if that would like open up a whole other legal world of using Disney characters in something, like if you said something like Batman, what kind of copyright infringements and nonsense world would that create?
Gosh, yeah, that's a really good point. Who knows? Because like, obviously you can't just, I remember looking at, I was going to create some cards and they were going to feature Beyonce because I'm a big fan, and I was going to put them on Thoughtful and I had the idea and everything. And then I was reading up on, you know, copyright and, you know, all the rules around using figures and people that are celebrities, etc. Then looked into like characters, cartoon characters, fictional or you know, and that sort of thing. And it's a really tricky area around actually, although it's me creating this artwork, it could be Beyonce, it could be Batman, but actually I don't own that, you know, I don't own their imagery. And so for me to recreate it, I could potentially get in trouble for then using it and profiting off it. So I think it caused even more problems that might be a reason it doesn't take off in the way that people think it might do, because of all the legal, you know, trying to navigate that.
The main application for this software will actually be folk like me who need a design asset for like a piece of content marketing or a Facebook ad, and just don't want to spend like, you know, £300 getting that made up by a designer in like, you know, what I would call like the lowest common denominator of kind of advertising design. And like the stuff with intellectual property rights around like, you know, Batman is very unique because that's a specific fictional character that there's a huge amount of lore behind and image rights, blah, blah, blah. What this software I would use is like, I'm working for a pet company and I want to create an image of a dog wearing sunglasses on holiday lying on a sun lounger. If I was to shoot that in a studio in London, would it be thousands and thousands of pounds? Because I'd have to get a dog model, I'd have to get a studio set up, I'd have to hire the studio, professional photographer, blah, blah, blah. Genuinely something like that, because it's something I've done in the past, not that specific example, can cost between £5,000 to £10,000. Whereas if in this software, I can get something maybe 80% as good for basically free. And I think that'll be the immediate disruption, is more kind of eating the lunch of brands like Shutterstock and various image places where you're looking more for stock photography rather than photography of celebrities or cartoon right characters. So I think that's where it has the most potential to disrupt in the short term. Longer term, God knows. You know, that piece spoke about text to video, which is just seems insane. But if I as a marketer could say that same scenario, dog chilling on holiday on a sun lounger, and it was like a dog being fanned on a sun lounger, and I could use that as the 10-second creative for an advert just by putting in some text into a piece of software, that it really is very cool and exciting. Yeah, you know, the last example the piece gave was 3D printers, and being able to type in a text prompt to the software connected to a 3D printer, and then the 3D printer would create that, having been procedurally generated by the AI. So yeah, there are some cool ideas, but it seems like maybe 5 years down the line rather than right now, where we'll be getting like houses printed by text commands.
I was astounded by that stat in the piece about video, how video occupies like 80% of all data on the internet right now. And then just imagine if you put tools in the folks' hands to just text to video create even more. You know what I mean? And so, you know, we know right now that video takes a, you know, a fair bit of time and bandwidth to create. But if you grow that exponentially by putting a tool like this in folks' hands, like, what does that mean for the size and scope and nature of just the internet as a whole? I think like the implications are pretty astounding there. Real quick, we'll move us to the next piece. One thing I really want to get this group's perspective on is just like the implications for the design profession. So this piece talks about, it's from Design Week, talking about, you know, Super Union offering creators this sort of proprietary design software that, you know, does a couple things, but allows them to create, you know, motion graphics and things like that, and even metaverse design. I thought the explanation from the digital director at Super Union Asia, Jessica Tan, gave, you know, this really great explanation about giving creative freedom to the client, you know, wanting them to be digital first, offering, you know, a higher level of creativity to the client. But also, to some extent, I think that takes power out of the hands of designers who work at agencies or even in-house. If clients have these sort of supercharged tools, you know, to be as expansive and creative with their designs. In terms of what the software does, they're looking at a couple things here. So it's basically a suite of tools for clients, and then it allows them to create digital assets and experiences through generative motion and metaverse design. So the tools use, you know, technologies like JavaScript, WebGL, and some custom algorithms that are tailored to those individual clients and needs. So curious to hear folks' reaction to this piece.
The thing that's popped into my head is, having worked with clients, you've worked with them for maybe some months, you know, you might have done some strategy, then you've moved on to brand identity, and then you get to that point where you hand over the files, you know, you hand over the vectors, I've got all these files, I've got PNGs, etc. You give them a bit of an overview of what to do, where they're meant to go, where they're meant to be used, and some clients get it, some clients don't. And I think if there's a tool that allows clients to be able to create assets that are on brand and accurate and look good and look professional, but it's based off the back of the work that we've done together, but it's giving them back control to an extent, but it means that they can continue to do what they want to do without constantly, you know, coming back to me or someone else, you know, it gives them a bit more freedom. I think that's okay. It would be, for selfish reasons, I like to see brands continue to look good and continue to show up in the world in the way that I'd envisage them. And sometimes that doesn't always happen. And it can be quite disheartening when you've worked with someone and you've given them all these rules and brand guidelines and things, and actually it's just they've not quite got the tools to be able to really execute what you'd have hoped. So if that's what this tool does, then I think it could be a good thing.
Just from looking at that article and seeing what type of work they're doing, and I think it's depending on the scale of the client and what type of project you're working on. Just from personal experience, I think these tools are something that I think, you know, my past experience, my creative team, we would have said, okay, we'll hire, you know, this is the ad campaign we're thinking for, you know, this rollout in Q3, and that will launch this, you know, like what part of the strategy of this. And we will say, we actually know a partner firm because we don't know how to do this ourselves, right? This is software that's beyond me. But it's up to the partner firm. I think we can say, you're the ones that can do this digital crazy setup for you from that immersive experience you want to build. And so we will still try to bring in the creative overall, you know, why they hire us for the strategy, the thinking of this is the creative direction for this campaign. But then we're asking the expertise because we don't know how to do the software or program. Like, then we have to hire this, you know, programmers, or maybe it is up to our digital team to just purchase the software. You know, so there's different ways that people that are involved creating these items are making money in a way, right? And so I don't know. That's just my experience that I don't know what it would be for these programmers or software designers or motion designers that does these things. Or I think they can use it to their benefit to work smarter. That's the only thing I can think of. It's okay, maybe we can't hire, you know, a whole 3D modeling team to create background universe for us, but we can take it, hire using the software to build the background for us, and then our team will take in, still direct the, you know, this animal's gonna pass through this area, or, you know, whatever the campaign is, right? The fantasy world land that it would create visually. So that's just my thinking of how it will run out in the actual world, how an agency operates these days for certain projects. I mean, I can see a lot of the 3D modelers might not be happy about it, but it might save them time from just how old school it was, where knowing that, you know, we would have to model every little thing in the world that's there. So if it's, we can ask the computer, I mean, it's already doing it for us. We're like saying, okay, it needs to be an apple at this corner, and this apple needs to look this color, and it's the sunset is this way, you know, like it's already, we've been doing that and playing with these tools for a long time. In a way, I fight a lot of other tools that's like Canva or other things, but then sometimes I have to think about the other side exactly, like, who are these agencies? Like, what are we doing for them? Or what do they actually need? And that's just a small part of it that I don't need. I think, yes, it's all like money and things that you like, okay, we could use this and then they can pay us for this. But sometimes I'm like, I have to step back and think the bigger picture. I think that's what you have to do as being a creative director or, you know, running an agency or trying to figure out what is the best for your clients. Overall branding strategy is like, okay, well, maybe that's just the one thing. We're like, okay, they need Canva, they need to create whatever, sure, but we can still set up saying, you know, you're purchasing into this bigger idea that we're making, we're coming up for you and making sure your companies will succeed. You know, I don't need to worry too much about this little thing that's you really need to launch sometimes to not have that control, you know, as our designer needs to create those things for them. So we can give them the kind of the templates and everything to set them up for it. And I think those are the battles you have to like choose as you operate these things, have a continuous relationship with your clients that you look out for.
Yeah, that's an interesting point about how it like opens up the possibility of empowering, I think, both clients and also users from like user generated content perspective to like take things off of your design team's plate that maybe you don't want them doing, you know. Some of the things we'll mention, maybe like, you know, lower order graphics or social creatives or something like that. So you can get into the deeper media, you know, design work.
Yeah, the cool example they had in the piece was user-generated content where, like, you donated money. And the way these tools work are you generate design assets, but based off of brand parameters. So it's very similar to a Canva template where you say, all right, these are the only colors that you can use. Here are the font files. But, you know, it's like that on steroids. The campaign they did was, like, you donated money to the charity. And in response, you got to see, like, a unique custom-generated version of the logo that was totally unique to your donation and like completely, you know, built there and then using the AI, but also totally on brand because it could only use the colors, fonts and shapes of nonprofits logo. Yeah, there's some cool stuff to do there with UGC and kind of like lower order graphics. But yeah, I agree with what you said, Annabelle. Like, I don't think we're never going to be at a place where the hard part of design and branding is building the brand. Then once you've built all those parameters, you can give it to an algorithm and they can, you know, do what they want with it. But all of the skill and artistry comes in the first bit. And, you know, yeah, that AI is like probably done some cool stuff with user generated content you couldn't do. And maybe you could take some stuff off of your like content marketing super boring design creation. But again, like that's the stuff that agencies and designers fucking hate doing anyway. Like, you know, it's like, I built you this brand. That doesn't mean I'm the only person that can now create design assets for you. Like, you know, we built you a brand guideline for it. That's meant to be what you use to run with it. So yeah, I almost kind of hope it maybe improves design from the bottom up while not really impacting designers, you know, income that much.
Question for Danielle and also Olivia or anyone. So I understand like building a brand and coming from if it's, you know, everyone's backgrounds, you know, graphic design, branding, and there's always that traditional part and you deal with the client, they're just like, well, I want this logo. Why does this logo cost so much? You have to always explain the value of that creation, right? But then we're also saying like the brand is not just this logo, but you think it is, but it is something that it's immediate and people see it, remember it, and, you know, this is you. But how do you feel about these websites that has, let's say, like, I shall not name it, but let's say a website tool that has the software that a lot of people use as templates, and I'm not, you know, I use certain services like that too, because sometimes when you're your own designer, it's so hard to build your own website. But they also have that service of like, we can create a logo for you for your small business for $150 or $50, I don't remember, but there's a lot of websites and services out there. My thing is, I'm trying to think, is it just same thing? It's taking everything that's already out there that's on the website. It's just stealing it or vectoring it and they just create their own. Or is it, I don't even know if they have their own fancy AI software or they're just exploiting, you know, using Fiverr and hiring these poor students from other countries, but it's still making money through certain means and they're just making them, you know, for $5 an hour, $10 an hour, here is create some logos for this client that they will pay $75 for from other places using our service. So I don't know how you feel about that realm of the generating these logos for these businesses and small entrepreneurs that are trying to make it in the world as well.
It used to bother me, Annabelle, if I'm honest. I used to get really pissed off. It used to really get on my nerves. But what I've realized now is that I think there's a place for everyone. I'm not saying it's right, but I think if you're a startup, for example, and you're really bootstrapped and, you know, you've got this idea, this thing that you want to bring out into the world and you've just got no money behind you, but you know you need a logo, it's probably the first place you're going to go. And I think it's made that accessible to people that really don't have the cash behind them to be able to invest, you know, hundreds or thousands of pounds into building a logo, a brand, you know, from the start up. The difference is that as professionals, as experts, as kind of trained practitioners that we are, like you say, it's much more than just a logo. And I think at the point somebody is ready to take their brand to that level, then they realize that it is much more than a logo. And if they want to look professional, if they want to stand out, differentiate, etc., then having a £5 logo off whatever isn't really going to cut it, then that's when they come to people like us when they're at that point. But I think everyone's got to start somewhere. It used to really annoy me, but now I just realised that people that use those sites and get those kind of logos, they're not my customer. Maybe when I was, you know, at college and I wanted some real life experience, I wanted to have a go at designing logos, you know, that would have been a great avenue for me to really just practice and actually have a real client and get paid a fiver, because at the time I really didn't have a clue what I was doing. But now obviously I'm not at that stage and that's okay. And I think it's okay. I personally think it's okay for people to use those services if they really need them.
I think I'm kind of the same, Danielle. I think I used to be a bit more against it. And then a few of my friends started branching out and making their own startups and wanting logos and things. And I'm like, oh, we probably can't afford an actual designer at this point. But, you know, there's a cheaper alternative. And it is still, you know, it's not necessarily taking jobs away from designers. There might still be a designers that they have in the loop. And also, you know, once people kind of move out of that startup phase or initial phase, they then go on to use proper designers, in air quotes, proper designers. So, you know, it's not like they're going to always use these cheaper services, always, you know, you're not paying the rights or whatever.
Yeah. And I've actually been guilty of doing that from a web perspective. You know, I remember wanting to get into web design, not having a clue, and using Wix and I'm trying to think of the other one. I can't remember what it's called.
Squarespace.
Yes, yes, that's it. And, you know, to a developer, they'd be like, what are you doing? You know, because that's their, they state it quite clearly, you know, get these websites without the need to use a developer, which for developers must be really annoying because that's their job. But that was the only way I could kind of start. And a lot of my initial clients didn't have the budget to pay for a developer. So it was a difference between them not having a website and them having a website. And I'm glad that that was out there for them to be able to actually have a brand and have a presence. Again, as you said, Olivia, as people grow, as brands grow, and they realise the need for a developer because maybe now they're in a position to include e-commerce, for example, they want it bespoke because the needs of their business has changed and actually the off-the-shelf one doesn't fit them, but now it does because they've got customers, they've got some money, so things have changed. And that's again when people go, actually, yeah, I want a bespoke website now, Wix or Squarespace isn't for me. So yeah, I've been guilty of it and I kind of get it.
No, I was the same way. So I think the longer you've been working in this and then the different clientele that come to you, or my cousin's uncle, auntie from university, someone has a this idea, can you help them? I'm like, oh, then, you know, why don't you use this? Because it just gets too complicated or whatever.
Nice segue into some of our interview questions. Danielle is having set up a company specifically for the people that are the smaller brands that have kind of made that jump from, you know, maybe I've designed a crappy logo on an automated site. Maybe I've built a website on one of those providers. And now I've made a little bit of money. I've got proven product market fit and it's time to bring in a designer, but I can't afford 50 grand a month, you know, some of those insane design agencies. So I'm going to go to Danielle Clark. Talk to us about setting up Danielle Clark Creative, the journey, like what was the inspiration behind it? What's some of the good work you've been doing?
The inspiration came from frustration, if I'm honest, a lot of disappointment. I've been made redundant probably technically 3 times in my career. The first time it was a massive shock. The second time, probably not quite so much because it just culturally, it just wasn't a good fit. I really didn't approve of the way that the team, you know, the directors and the CEOs, their values didn't align with mine at all. We're a million miles away from each other. And in my head, I wasn't going to stick around, but it kind of happened before I was ready. And then the third time it happened, me and my partner had just bought a house. So literally the day that we got the keys on the Friday, I had a phone call from the CEO on a Saturday. I was like, why is he calling me? Yeah, I just had enough of not being in control of my own career and what was happening. I knew I was good at, you know, what I do, and I knew that I wanted to do good work and I wanted to work with people that just were nice people, that weren't dicks and weren't just solely focused on making money. I didn't want to do soulless stuff that didn't inspire me and that I didn't feel like was genuinely making a difference. And so I just decided to just start up on my own. I spent ages thinking about names. I got really obsessed with names. I remember talking to a friend. I really love the word forward. I've actually got it on, oh, it's going to be in reverse, but I've actually got it on my wall. It's just a really powerful word and it's part of the Birmingham's motto, you know, this idea of moving forward, pushing forward, not looking back, moving forward with purpose, all that stuff. And I was obsessed with being called Forward, but I couldn't find URL. I tried loads of different ways to try and spell it and everything, and it didn't happen. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to stick with Danielle Clark Creative because that's me. I'm Danielle Clark and Creative. It's got a nice little ring to it. And yeah, that was it really. And I've not really looked back.
I'm super curious to hear, like you told us a couple, unfortunately harrowing stories about being made redundant a couple of times. How have you navigated the world of marketing and branding and design to some extent as a woman and as a woman of color?
It's been really hard. When I was graduating, I remember looking, as you do, you know, I had my portfolio, I had my book in this big folder and I'd come up with my own logo and everything. And you start looking, you're looking at agencies, mainly in London, and you're looking at creative directors and the CEOs, and, you know, no one looked like me. And I really had to have a long think about whether graphic design was really for me, because it didn't feel like it was. It nearly put me off going into the industry, but I managed to land a job quite quickly just because I was relentless and sent a lot of CVs and emails to people, and just I had real ambition. I think people saw that. But yeah, it's been tough. I've been pigeonholed, I've been passed over for promotions and kind of made to feel like when I told line managers and people that I wanted to progress, that I wanted more responsibility and that I wanted that to be reflected in my salary, it was like, who do I think I am asking for that? Being told to wait, too ambitious, I guess. So yeah.
Being told to wait thing is the thing that like burns my grits the most. It's sort of like feels like that's reserved for certain folks, you know, like women or folks of color. And like, it like, just, I always wonder like where that sense of almost like the opposite of entitlement. It's like, you know, you need to like kind of wait your turn or wait, you know, like where that comes from, and the willingness of folks to be like, progress takes time, but you know, obviously that progress doesn't apply to them most times. So
yeah, it's difficult, but I think I've always had this determination in me. I think that's another reason why I love sport as well. I'm extremely competitive. I really want to win. If someone tells me that I can't do something or that something's not for me, it's like lighting a fire. And I've just got to go for it. And so being told that just made me want it even more. And I always try and focus on the things that I'm in control of. I used to think that being employed by someone meant that I was secure. And my mindset completely shifted after those three redundancies. And I realized that actually, if it's me and my own business, I know exactly what's going on. I know all the numbers. I know how many clients, you know, I'm working with. I understand the inner workings of a business that's actually way more secure. So yeah, here we are.
100%. You've got a couple of cool side hustles as well. You're a lecturer at Birmingham University, and obviously, as we mentioned, a podcast host yourself. Talk to me about those. Like, you know, how did you get into them? What do you love about them? You know, what are they like?
The lecturing happened by accident. I went to Birmingham Design Festival, which started about 3 years ago. Went to a talk, which I wasn't going to go to. It was all about wayfinding. And I went because I didn't understand what wayfinding was and I wanted to learn more. I learned about the relationship between wayfinding and graphic design and the way ultimately it helps us get around places, be it cities, hospitals, schools, etc. And then the lecturer was a woman. And I was saying how inspiring it was to find a woman in that position at such a high position, kind of leading and had loads of experience. And then I found out that she was lecturing at Birmingham Uni, and I talked about my experience of being a graduate, looking at the space. You know, none of my lecturers looked like me. No one in the industry looked like me at the time. And it really bothered me. And I was saying that I really wanted to give something back. And she told me to keep in touch, and we did. And then an opportunity to go in and talk to the students came about. I went in. I purposely didn't show any of my work because I remember being at uni and people coming in and showing work and showing how amazing they are and not really getting any value from it. So I just decided to talk about my journey, my failures and stuff. The students clearly resonated with them, and then a position came up to be a visiting lecturer. And I was like, oh, okay. That sounds cool. Let's give it a go. And then where the podcast is concerned, I just really like talking. It was the thing that was always on my report at school. I always had a really good report, but there was always that bit Danielle tends to talk too much. Danielle distracts others because of her chatting. So I just thought I'd just put it to good use and do a podcast.
That's right. Make lemonade. Just make that space for yourself. It's great. Love it.
I was curious to hear, Olivia and Annabelle, have either of you or both of you had experiences like that that kind of charted your course differently or pushed you forward a bit more like that?
Yes. Also, as a woman of color, I think there's always so many phases that it's so funny when you talk to other designers and maybe, you know, they're male or white passing or whatever. And it's so funny when you mention the space, you're like, well, it's just not that. Like, I'm trying to make it as, you know, a woman in this industry, in the design world. And also in New York, it's super competitive. I'm very happy that I'm able to kind of been, you know, amongst the crowd and know all the, you know, whoever is there, like in this industry here. But sometimes, like, you had to remind them. And I literally had genuine conversations with other male colleagues, and they're like, oh, I never thought about it like that. I was like, well, yeah, of course not. Like, you never had to. So I was like, it's not just being a woman, it's a woman of color, and then, like, trying to compete in this. And then sometimes people can get so, I'm also experiencing it myself, or I find myself sometimes during that where you get too possessive of, like, the space you've created for yourself, and then you just have to, like, let that go and be like, what is the point? And no one else can also, you know, have this life that you once had for yourself or whatever it is. It's whatever your experience. And I think being this industry for a while, that the hustle of, like, the agency world, sometimes you're like, oh, this is great, and let's fuel you. It's the same thing, the competitiveness of the male that speaks of. Because then you've been told so many times you can't, so then it's like, well, I will show you. And a lot of times that before, when you're younger, it's more like face-to-face. And then I think, no, now you kind of, like, read the crowd. You're like, okay, well, maybe, like, I keep saying, like, okay, well, here's what's the other strategy so that I can make this other niche for myself or make this other, create this other world, just be with different clientele. As you get older, you just realize, you're like, okay, let's, you know, get beaten down so many times. But then you're just like, just make our own space and, you know, keep knowing what you're creating, what that purpose is, right? And I think that's when Paul and I first met. I always say, like, I'm seeing it where I just, there's clients that you work with that you just kind of like, okay, well, that's going to pay the bills, you know, pay for, take care of family stuff. And then there are clients that you're like, what's the purpose that you want to keep working with? That purpose aligned with your values. And so it's nice.
I distinctly remember a conversation I had with one of my lecturers at university where they told me and one of my other girlfriends on the course that graphic design was a male-dominated industry and we would struggle to find jobs unless we really, really applied ourselves. And I don't know if I'm massively competitive, but I do know I'm driven on spite. So if someone tells me that I can't do something or that it's going to be hard for me, that's all the drive I need to try and achieve that. So as soon as, you know, someone says, oh, you know, it's probably going to be a bit harder for you to find, like, a space in this area, I'll be like, is it?
Competition is just driven by spite with good PR.
Right.
Wanted to get this crew's opinion about, you know, the recent development of Adobe acquiring Figma, and just broadly, like, what do you think this signals for the future of design tech? And does it seem like we're moving, you know, towards a design world where, you know, it's kind of sat on a knife edge between corporate hegemony and you know, some of those micro tools that we've talked about, like Canva?
Danielle, do you want to take this first?
Yeah, I think AI is definitely here. I think, you know, we've talked about tools that designers use. You know, there's all sorts of photo enhancers and, you know, the text to image, and there's even like sketch to code now. We've talked about logo makers, etc. It's helping other people to be creative, this bridge between amateur designers and then more seasoned designers, more professional designers. I think that this, like, the acquisition of Figma and Adobe, you know, again, Figma is, it's all about UX and UI, but without the need for developers again. And so it's kind of bridging that gap in terms of, if you don't have that skill set, you can still create things. So if you're a little bit more amateur and you're not as seasoned, it's going to allow you to be able to create things. And I think it's going to allow a lot more people that maybe don't see themselves as creatives and haven't studied and haven't, you know, done courses, etc. It's going to give them the tools to be able to be creatives as well. You know, it used to be that if you had paint, back in the day you were a you were a designer, and then it became okay, actually, if you've got Photoshop, you're a graphic designer. And now we know that's not true, but it took a while before people realized. And I think it's just, yeah, I think in time something else will come along. There'll be more tools and more products kind of arrive that maybe that make it seem like designers are, you know, designers and developers' jobs are being taken away from them. But I think in time we'll see what these tools can really do, and there'll be other things that come along that change that again.
Yeah, it's the same. It was a lot of range of emotions when this news first came out, and then you realize, oh, the deal has already been done, right? You know, it's like any big corporations, and I think it's the same like conversation. I was listening to the other podcast saying, you know, Sony acquiring these people, or Disney acquiring, you know, Lucasfilms and Marvel and all this stuff. It's either for them, it was like IP and, you know, all these other ranges of money-making facets within corporations of Disney, right? But with this, I think it's either Adobe is just like, well, everyone's using Figma, and we don't, either they create their own shitty tool of, I mean, I didn't use XD at all. Like, it was more like the collaborative of, I think, Figma. Figma was hard for me at first. I think it's not as intuitive as any of the Adobe programs have trained us designers to use. But I think Figma did open up my eyes of, wow, it's so much more collaborative, and the idea of like everyone can be on this one file to me was also different than Sketch, because I think they made it fun, and I think the look and feel was very accessible for people that could use it. I just hope that it would be something they're not going to destroy, and it's more of letting Figma exist on their own, and then Figma, like what the Figma, you know, CEO says, that the power behind Adobe and their money and their technology that's already developed, right, trying to compete with these other softwares, like they've been trying to compete with Canva for a while, the Adobe Express and stuff. So, but it's just a matter of, for me, is the price point, because I would keep saying, I would like explain to friends that, like, you know, back in the day, there'll just be free software when you're a student or you're just starting out freelancer, like buying Adobe software was like so expensive and there's no way to afford it. And but somehow there'll be that random CD that someone left behind that can say, there is, you know, Adobe Illustrator, you know, 7 on here that you can install, and then we just, everyone have access to it. And that was the only way. And I love that aspect of it. And then it's now, is it affordable? I don't know, for students. And so Figma was a way for any freelancers or people starting out or curious to be self-taught UX, UI designers to kind of explore that. So yeah, we'll see.
Mimicking what Annabelle was saying, but I think I'm a bit less optimistic about Adobe's intentions with Figma, shall we say. Because, you know, Figma had so many cool, like, free options to use, and you didn't have to sign up to this horrifically overpriced subscription that Adobe have. Adobe just seems to be this like huge conglomerate kind of absorbing all the little guys, which is a bit disheartening. I kind of also wonder when they're going to go for Canva, because Canva's next on the chopping block, surely, for Adobe to acquire, right?
My understanding is that they've offered in the past and Canva told them to fuck off because they know that they can just make so much more money by being better and lower at access point. Two things. One, I love how you said intentions as if it was like someone asking to date your child. What are your intentions towards my Figma? And two, yeah, totally agree. I don't understand what it is about the digital world that means people don't employ massive conglomerate laws where you just stop this kind of monopoly from happening. But it's not good. Like, it's not a good thing. Adobe will 100% not leave Figma alone. They will do that for a year so that they don't lose half of their usership. And then slowly but surely, they will integrate it into the Adobe suite. Like, that's the only reason that you would buy them, other than just literally turning them off. So yeah, I don't think it's good news. And I think it's what we keep seeing in the tech space in various different verticals. You know, it's the same as Facebook just buy anyone or try to buy anyone who's a competitor to them. You know, Amazon buy any marketplace that looks like it can rival them. And the only way you end up with a genuine competitor like Etsy or not on the high street is someone defines a niche and then refuses several multi-million or in this case, multi-billion dollar proposals. You know, you need a really unique idea, quite frankly, a borderline psychotic disdain for large sums of money
to ever get to the point where you write, you know, you could even eat 10% of the lunch of some of these businesses. So yeah, it's a mad world. I don't think it's a good thing for the world of design, personally.
Do you think companies like Figma are worried about companies like Adobe creating something that's very similar and then them becoming obsolete? Because I think about when I was at college, there were two programs that I used to use that no longer exist. One was CorelDRAW and one was Freehand. Everyone used them. And then now they just don't exist because Adobe created Illustrator and then InDesign. So maybe there's that fear of history repeating itself, you know, becoming obsolete because Adobe makes something that is on par with Figma and then people stop using Figma.
I think it's very difficult when you've only been around for 5 years and someone offers you $10 billion to say anything other than yes.
And that.
We had this sort of hypothetical for you, Danielle. We're curious about, you know, if you were hired by, say, a big tech startup, got onto their board, and you were sort of their design and brand guru, marketing guru, what would you advise them in terms of like managing their design team, branding team in this modern day and age, thinking about all these tools that we've just talked about and just the new landscape we're in?
I think the thing I'd start with is not being fearful of new programs. Having taught quite a few students, for example, we are introducing them to InDesign, and there was a whole table that were like, hate InDesign, it's crap, don't want to use it. And they're creating editorials, and I was like, well, you know, when you get into industry, you're probably going to have to do some editorials and some layout, and you're going to need to know how to use InDesign. And they were like, can't we just do it in Photoshop or Illustrator, like it's so much easier. And so I had to break it down for them. I had to give them an example of when I worked on a 300 page catalogue and what that looked like, and setting up master pages. And if someone decides that they need to change the position of page numbers a few millimeters, you know, you're going to go through every single page and make that change individually, or you're going to hop over to your master pages and change it there. And once I explained it to them, you know, the capabilities of InDesign and that actually it's going to save them a whole heap of time, that's when they started to go, oh, okay, so there is a real purpose to using this program. I think it's like with anything, you know, anything new, whether you're a seasoned designer that's getting used to all these new programs and new technologies, or you're a graduate that's just starting out, I think it's just about giving them a go, giving programs a go, trying them, seeing what the pros and cons are, what the benefits are around using them, and how it's going to improve your workflow and potentially save you time, which then obviously ultimately saves money, doesn't it, in the long run? Just giving designers the opportunity to try programs out and not be too fearful about like making mistakes or something going wrong. That's always, I think, the biggest fear, you know, fear of the unknown, not being confident in it. So creating the space to allow them to do that.
Olivia, Annabelle, how would you advise your new team at your big tech startup you're now on the board of?
That's what we get paid to do. You need to be careful, like not too much advice.
Just a little bit. Just a teaser.
Probably quite similar to what Danielle said. I remember, I think I was one of those students, Danielle, who I learned on Photoshop and would only use Photoshop all throughout university. And I remember one of my lecturers being like, I am not going to let you finish this course and have only used Photoshop. You will use Illustrator. You will use InDesign. And I was adamant that I wouldn't. Now I'm a huge advocate for them. They're the best. My God. Past Olivia was not making any sense. So yeah, I'd kind of just echo your sentiments there of not being afraid to try new things out and just be adventurous, like with designs and stuff. Don't be scared to like push boundaries and try something new. Like I know there's huge like structure in a lot of conventional graphic design, but some of the more fun graphic design goes back to like the old 60s style of like Reagan and David Carson, where there is no structure and there is no sense to it, but it works and it looks great. Have fun with it.
Yeah, that's something we're really encouraging at the moment, because we're getting them to understand the grid. And we were referencing David Carson and another designer called Will, I've forgotten his surname, but he redesigned The Independent and The Guardian. And we're getting them to understand the grid. And then, but we're saying like, once you understand it, break it. it's all about taking what you know and then going, okay, that's what I know. These are the rules. How can I push past them now and break them? What can I create? So yeah, totally agree there, Olivia.
There's a reason why they asked you to be on the board, right? So I think if they're asking you, then you're like, it's nice to, you know, whatever that word, a little disruptive, you know, disruptor in the industry. I think it's nice to change it up, yeah, because I think just within our design practices is the same way. I love the grid. I am very much the product of a lot of those Western, you know, Swiss typography, Dutch graphic design, taught work class student theories. But then even within that, like, you see how I think that's like what you have to learn. It's like, as graphic designers, I think I always say I need to know what the parameters are so I can try to push it as far as I can, right, to that border, depending on the client, depending on the project. Just have fun with it. I don't know, it depends on what type of board, what type of startup. See what I'm doing? I'm like, I need to know the parameters. Who are these people that they ask me?
Yeah, you need the brief. Give me the brief.
I need a brief. Who are these people that's going to ask me to be on the board?
All good. Well, I want to move us into the lightning round where we kind of get into more interesting, cheeky, personal questions for our guests. So first things first, Danielle, just curious to hear about what's been a game-changing piece of tech in your life.
It's going to sound really boring and cliche, but it's been Zoom. Purely because before the pandemic, there was no way in hell I would have jumped on a video call with someone. I'd have been like, no, I would like come way out of my comfort zone because we just didn't do it. And then pandemic came and literally had no choice. But now it's just so easy to connect with people that are overseas. And I've worked with a client in America. I did a podcast with, you know, someone in Canada. You know, we've connected. And without Zoom, there's no way I'd have been able to connect with these people. So yeah, it's been a real game changer for me, that. And it's just made me more comfortable being on video. Again, something I wasn't particularly comfortable with. But because of using Zoom and seeing my own face all the time on screen, I'm fine on video. You know, I started doing video content on, you know, social media, other social media platforms. I'm much more open to FaceTiming, you know, or doing WhatsApp video for, you know, other calls or even just talking to friends. Again, something I was just like, why are you video calling me? It was never something I was particularly comfortable with, but now I just am. And I think it's because of that as well. It's allowed me to be able to do my podcast and talk, and, you know, even like today, it's something I'm much more comfortable with. So yeah, Zoom, definitely.
What is one problem tech cannot solve for and why?
Emotion and empathy and humor. You know, we said at the start that with AI, you have to kind of put data in first in order to get an output. And when you're dealing with humans, you don't need to do that. You know, our brains allow us to do that. The influence that we take in, the way we get inspired from, you know, whether it's music or a film or being out in nature or whatever, all of those things influence and have an impact on the creative output that we have. And our life experiences have an impact on the way that we think and the things that we say and do. And having that diversity of thought, I think, is really important for creativity. And that's just not something that AI can do. I just don't see it as possible. There's no nuances, there's no emotion. I don't think AI could come up with, you know, a really funny pun. The Dollar Shave Club, one of their puns is shave time, shave money. Could AI come up with that? I don't think so.
Our favorite question, or my favorite question, at least, tech for bad. What's the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there?
Yeah, I read this question and I was like, evil tech? Like, are we talking like James Bond-esque, Dr. Evil-esque? And then I had a real think, and I was thinking about my own experience with tech and times where tech's maybe not necessarily been evil, but I thought, oh, that's not good. And it was actually with, am I allowed to say the app? Is that bad? I don't know. Yeah, okay. So it was actually with Strava. So I was using Strava. I used to run. I don't so much now, but I do run when I play hockey, and I do use Strava for walks and other things like that. What I didn't realize is that it will pinpoint where you started your journey and where it ends. and that if people are following you, they can see that. And you can kind of tap on it and it does this really cool thing where it starts off as like the whole world and then it zooms in on where you were. And I was like, so everybody can see the time I've been for a run, where I was and where I ended, and basically work out where I live and work out my routine. I was like, that's not cool. That's like really unsafe.
So I use Strava a lot, and they've updated that where you can click a button and it says like it kind of blurs the start and end point. It's not perfect.
Yeah, I tried using that, but it was still, you know, I think it was like within a radius of like a mile or two. But I was like, it can still, like, it doesn't take a genius to work out where you live still. So I've just literally switched it off. So like people are following me, but they can't see anything. And so, yeah, I told my friends, but I specifically told my female friends because I didn't know if they were aware of that. And again, this is, if you're a guy, you probably don't have to think or, you know, consider that sort of stuff as much. But as a female, I was like, I'm going to tell all the hockey girls about this because I know a lot of them use Strava and a lot of them go running and like, that's not cool. Not so much evil, but just as a safety thing, I think that needs addressing.
That same app, when it first came out, accidentally revealed the location of a number of secret US Army bases because all of the US troops were like using it. And it was just showing like, why is there all of these army folk running circles in like the desert of Afghanistan? They're like, oh, it's probably an airbase there. So yeah, Strava has a surprising amount to answer for. On the flip side of that, if you could dream up a new tech product, what would it be and what problem would it solve?
The answer came to my head straight away, and it would be a health app for business owners and entrepreneurs, because I think we're the most stressed, most sleep deprived demographic, helping with burnout and, you know, maybe diet. You know, a lot of people, if you're busy, you're not eating properly, you're probably not sleeping properly. So just helping people be aware of those things, because I think a lot of the time it's awareness. You kind of get into a routine and think that it's a norm. And I think it might be useful to have some sort of app that makes you realize what the norm is or what you should be doing, and then help you kind of get back to something that's going to make you feel good again.
Open this one up to the whole panel here, but just curious about your predictions for design tech and just sort of what you see happening over the next year or so.
What's really interesting is there's a lot of kind of tech for good coming out at the moment. And I think the reason being is that the younger generation, they're quite clued up and they're not afraid to kick up a fuss. They're quite comfortable kind of calling businesses and organizations when they feel like they're not doing what they should be doing. With like talk of like the metaverse, and I, like so many other people, have had, you know, had a conversation with someone about, for example, paddle boards. And then all of a sudden I'm getting adverts for paddle boards on Instagram and Facebook. And I'm going, that's weird. Are they actually listening to me? Or is it because of my search history, or, you know, that sort of thing? And what I think's really good actually is this guy that appeared on Dragon's Den that pitched the Generate app. So it's all about giving control back to the consumer, back to the individual. So it's this idea that at the minute, because the thing that everyone wants is your data, your information, like the information space is like blowing up. And so he's created this app that allows you to either stop companies completely from having your data and everything staying private, or if you choose to share it, you get paid. So I think that's tech being there for good, for sure, because it's giving the power back to the individual and taking it away from these big organizations that are ultimately taking our data and we're not benefiting from it. So
I kind of wonder if there might be some kind of, like, you know, we're just kind of speaking about like Gen Z being really hot on societal issues, and I also think they're really, really hot on climate change. So I kind of wonder if there might be some tech for good that comes up in that kind of space, whether that's like a, I don't know, a recycling app or something along those kind of lines. I'm hopeful that something nice might pop up like that. But yeah, that's kind of the space that I can think of.
There's things a little bit like that popping up. I remember back in the day, there was like a free cycle that popped up, but it was really clunky and it wasn't really, but that started getting quite popular. But more recently, things like there's an app where you can see what stores are like throwing away food and you can go get food really cheap. Can't remember what it's called. My memory's awful.
Too Good To Go.
That's it, like Too Good To Go. I think there's more stuff like that around, like, you know, trying to save food and stop waste and protect the environment. I think there'll be loads more coming out.
Cool. Unless there's any other predictions, I think that's a good place to wrap up. I want to thank all of you for being so generous with your time. I know we went over a little bit here. We're grateful to have you on talking about the future of design tech. Our guest today, Danielle Clark, marketing and brand consultant and host of Build Better Brands podcast. Check out Build Better Brands. Where can folks find you, Danielle, and all your stuff on the interwebs?
People can find me on LinkedIn. I hang out there quite a bit. Just search for Danielle Clark or my company, Danielle Clark Creative. Website's the same, Danielle Clark Creative, soon to be updated as well. Yeah, the podcast is Build Better Brands. So just search for that wherever you like to listen to your podcasts.
That's awesome. We'll chuck those links in the episode description. Also want to thank Olivia Messer, our senior designer at Literal Humans, and Annabelle Pang, our creative director and partner. Thanks, y'all.
Great work.
Thanks, bye.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.